when I think about my own youth and my children, how I would advise a congregant's child to confront a bully. Sometimes you meet strength with strength. Sometimes you push back, but sometimes you have to use the bully's energy against them. Volodymyr Zelensky seems to know how to do that. When asked, "Can we evacuate you?" he said, "I don't need a ride, I need bullets." It seems that his training as a comedian and an actor has stood him in good stead. That throughout this whole experience of the past week plus of invasion and being chased by assassins, he's maintained a self-effacing humor and an ability to be courageous in the face of one of the greatest bullies this world knows. And has become, contrary to all expectation, an incredible leader of his people. By being, to all appearances, authentic, self-effacing, not willing to be dragged down by the bullies of Russian forces. And the people of Ukraine seem to have picked up on that sense of humor, offering to tow broken down and run out of gas tanks back to Russia. So, when we talk about the priestly garments of the past weeks, they of course had the 12 stones that represented the 12 tribes, the 12 sons of Israel. And they were intended to keep the names of those people over their heart, to rest them over their chest as they officiated and adjudicated the ritual life of the ancient people. And elsewhere were described multiple times that the various parts of the priestly garments were knotted together, were adhered together such that they wouldn't tear, they were woven. That, to me, is the work of leadership we're seeing now. That in our own country and, frankly, worldwide, I think to the consternation of the Russian president's anticipation, there's a lot of unity. There's a lot of awareness of the fragility of life and those we must look after who are more vulnerable than we, either as individuals or as states, that the rules of Europe and the world that might makes right and that the strongest will overtake the weakest is no longer something we want to live under. I think David Brooks called this the essence of the original liberal idea, that strength isn't the ultimate decider of human fate. And people like Zelensky and Scholz in Germany and others are ensuring that we keep in mind those who are suffering and that we don't allow the fragile union both of Europe and the world to be torn asunder. Chazanit Shush and I were talking a couple weeks ago about the whole point of these parshiot that seem so detail-oriented, and to those who are not artistic or architecturally minded might not be as appealing, but I feel like the punchline is pretty intense, which is the climax at the very end of the parsha is that when all the work is done, the Shekhinah descends. And Rashi says this is the ultimate blessing of all of Jewish life, is that the Shekhinah, God's presence, should fill, that holiness should fill our work. But the Imre Sofer, Yochanan Sofer, writing about 100 years ago in Hungary, said that blessing doesn't deposit on an empty vessel. The split between sacred work and profane work is human effort. Sacred work might call avodah, the work of service, and profane work is melacha, the work of craftsmanship and cooking and skinning and tanning, things like that in the ancient world, and in our world, maybe mowing one's lawn. You have to do it, not resting with your hands clasped so that God will help you, not sitting on the roof waiting for rescue, praying for rescue, but not accepting help, not participating in your own deliverance. And Rashi's blessing, says the Imre Sofer, comes only with the condition that you yourselves be partners in the work. And the amazing partnership we're seeing worldwide, not just that Zelensky is inspiring, but other world leaders and even humble citizens are inspiring as they take up arms against oppressors. As I said, violence ought not always be the answer, and strength ought not always be matched with strength. But there is, in all of it, not just a sense that the weapons are there to kill and prevent, but that the weapons are a sense of inspiration and a sense of self-determination and a sense of self-worth and the worth of one's home. This is also Refugee Shabbat, organized through the Hebrew International Aid Society, HIAS. I think it would have existed were it not, whether or not we saw the outbreak of a war 10 days ago. And of course, you know, the Torah in so many times tells us to be aware of and alert to and caring for the stranger, literally the refugee. And that is 100%. The asylum seeker, the refugee, the immigrant is the word for ger. Ger also means a convert, but also in the sense of one who comes from another place, from another land, one who is an expatriate. And the power of the confluence of these times of the war in Ukraine, the war against Ukraine, and the righteousness and the self-humor and the spiritual uplift and resistance of people like Volodymyr Zelensky, and the confluence of that coming with the mass waves of nearly a million immigrants flowing out of Ukraine, surprisingly not more because so many have stayed to defend their homeland, is to point out to us that life is, I think, for the Israelite people, for Hebrews and Jews, a life of constant movement. And this convenience we have of offices and homes and nests, these large-scale nests writ large for human beings, is a kind of folly. And the truth is more like Sukkot and the wilderness. The Yesod Olam, writing in Toledo in 1310, said, at all times, from the wilderness today, in Israel's travels, as described in this week's parasha, the cloud and the smoke cover them. He doesn't say but I think he means but. To this day, the purpose and meaning of Israel's travels is not revealed, nor does it have an end. He was probably living in the instability of the late medieval Spanish period, but truth be told, it's still true now in America that wandering is the human nature. And we're lucky when we find some stability by moments. But the soul is itself a refugee. That the nature of Ukrainians fleeing their homeland, God willing, one day to return, of Jews fleeing their homeland millennia ago and again to this day, of Palestinians fleeing their lands, it's a piece of the nature of the human, that we are always in refuge. We are always seeking refuge. David Geffen named his first record company Asylum Records, which was to say that I'm giving asylum to the wandering artists, to the musicians who would come here. Yudah Leib Ginsburg, writing about a century ago in Russia, and then he arrived in Denver, of all places, said in his book, The Yalkut Yehuda, even rest is part of travel. One must be prepared to journey at all times. That Shabbat is a part of work, that rest is a part of travel, that peace is a part of strife. Sun Tzu would say that very clearly. Sun Tzu says that you make war to prepare for peace. And all of these are flow into each other like the yin and yang symbols. And our goal with each other, as the European Union has engaged in, as America has engaged in, as countries worldwide have engaged in, is to care for each other, to ensure that we have the resources to survive, thrive, and sustain through all of these vicissitudes of travel and life and refugee status and asylum that we seek at all moments, literally and spiritually. In the book of Deuteronomy, there's the most odd thing that we are enjoined to connect to not abhor, to not reject the Edomite and the Egyptian, but the Ammonite and the Moabite shall be our enemies, that shall never be allowed within our communities. And the reason given in Deuteronomy is because they did not meet us with food or water after we left Egypt. That sort of inhospitability, that sort of rejection of the other, is among, no, perhaps the greatest crime in Torah, that and living according to one's own lights. That we are essentially bound in a mutual network of common destiny, and that God's will for us is what we try to ascertain, and in God's will is the desire to care for the vulnerable, the stranger, the refugee, the asylum seeker. And I think in my own life and the lives of those I've observed, the single greatest impediment to supporting others, to giving, whether it's charity or volunteership, is a sense that we might not have enough. That if we give to charity today, what if we don't have enough to eat tomorrow? And in the prosperity gospel of the Christian world, there's this sense that if you give, you will be rewarded. And we don't think that way Jewishly. I was watching a show that was recommended to me by the Perez's called Somebody Feed Phil, where this Nebuchadnezzar Jewish guy travels the world. It's like Anthony Bourdain played by a Nebuchadnezzar Jewish guy. He travels the world and he meets people and he loves every food he has and he adores every person and he gives, you know, extra cookies to his crew and to passersby. It's a really charming show. And he's in Montreal and he goes to a deli there. I was curious to call Rosalie to see if she knows this deli. It's apparently the most famous Jewish deli. I don't believe it's kosher. It's probably kosher style. And they serve the coffee there at room temperature. And he asks the owner of the coffee store, why do you serve it at room temperature? I have a guess, but I'm curious what you do that for. And the owner says, so that people don't linger too long with their coffee. And we turn over the table. He says, ah, so very Jewish. But the truth is, we'll always have enough. At some level, as Pirkei Avot points out, that real richness is just being grateful for what we have. And I think even amid the Ukrainians and Zelensky and the refugees, there are those who are just grateful. There are those that show pride in who they are and gratitude for what they have. And even amid the difficulties of the past 2 years, those of us who maintained our health, those of us who didn't get hospitalized, those of us who didn't have long COVID, and even some of us who did experience some of those terrors, can have gratitude for arriving in a place of relative stability, or even gratitude for existing through such a monstrously difficult time. The Midrash hints at that, based on a section in this week's parasha, the idea that the glory of God fills the tabernacle, but to quote the Book of Kings, heaven and earth cannot contain God. So what's the answer to this paradox, they ask? Can God be contained? Can God be placed in one space as small as a tabernacle? Or is God ephemeral and untouchable and improbable and unreachable? Is God finite or infinite, I guess is the way we'd said. Or can God make God's self finite, as in the Christian faith, God incarnates God's self into Jesus to make God finite and experience passion and compassion? Does that concept exist Jewishly? And the answer, according to Yoshua of Sachnin in the name of Rabbi Levi, says, of course, that paradox can exist and can, to an extent, be resolved by way of a metaphor. He says it's like an open cave, a grotto at the edge of the sea. And when I hear this metaphor, I always think about the grottos in the very far north of Israel, Rosh HaNikra, perhaps my favorite spot in the whole country, at the border of Lebanon, and these incredible grottos in the cliffs facing the sea. And I wonder if that's what they were picturing. It's an open cave facing the sea. When the sea storms, the cave is filled, but the sea is not reduced. That there's more than enough to go around. That the godliness of the world is somewhat illimitable, to use E. Cummings' word. Though technically a physicist would quibble that, yes, the sea is reduced by entering the cave, but it's imperceptible and unnoticeable and immaterial. We have the power to resist. We have the power to support the refugee and the immigrant. We have the power to maintain laughter and self-effacement in the face of horror. And we have the power to be courageous in ways small and large. And that sea is, as Ecclesiastes would note, unending.